and that is Ms. Vaness and Mr. Chanville. I'm sure the parties are ready since we're running a bit late, and I didn't ask, but does anyone want to reserve it, being you, Ms. Vaness? Do you decide to reserve any rebuttal?
No, I don't.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And you may proceed if you're ready.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Jean Vaness. I represent the appellant, James Andre Moore, in this appeal. Briefly, the facts are fairly simple. Involves a theft at a department store. Defendant left the store with items and was followed almost immediately by the Suffolk Police Department, and was stopped. Mr. Moore was a passenger in the vehicle. The car was driven by a Mr. Suggs, whose sister owned the vehicle. Mr. Moore had gotten a ride from Mr. Suggs. When he was stopped, police officer Patton asked Mr. Moore if he had taken anything from the store. Mr. Moore said yes, and police officer asked him for the items back. He reached into the back seat, gave the officer a pair of pants that he had taken from the store. Subsequent thereto, the police officer asked Mr. Suggs if the car could be searched. Mr. Suggs consented to the search, and underneath the passenger seat, which Mr. Moore was sitting, was found a bag of cocaine and a bag of marijuana. Mr. Moore was subsequently arrested, charged with possession of marijuana and possession with the intent to distribute. At trial, the possession charge was reduced to simple possession, and the marijuana second offense was reduced to first offense. He was found guilty, and this appeal ensued. Our issues are basically that there were no indicia sufficient for a finding beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Moore was in possession of the cocaine and the marijuana. He had not made any movements in the car prior to the police officer asking him to retrieve the goods. He made a movement to the back seat in response to the police officer's request. He had no indication that he was that the car belonged to him. In fact, it was found that when the officer asked for driver's license and registration, that the car belonged to the driver's sister. The items were found under the passenger seat, so there was only mere proximity to the illegal substances from which the court found that Mr. Moore, in fact, knowingly possessed the drugs. The court found that upon Mr. Moore's testimony, that because he had been a convicted felon, he was not telling the truth, and two factors for which the Commonwealth brought up in their response brief was that that a court is free to disregard the testimony of any witness. However, I would suggest that may well be the case, but there must be something that occurs during the trial to indicate that that witness is not telling the truth. It can't just conclude based upon a single element of a prior conviction that the person is not telling the truth. And all of the there was no contradicting evidence to Mr. Moore's testimony. There was nothing else other than the mere proximity to the substances to indicate that Mr. Moore himself was knowing and intentionally possessing the illegal substances.
Ms. Vaness, this is Judge Beals. Can I ask you, when the court made its findings, he said certain things, like some of which you just referred to. And then he said he's engaged in movements, furtive at least, movements inside the car with respect to the items taken from the store. The drugs are under his seat. What does that mean? Is that a factual finding that he engaged in furtive movements to try to draw the officer's attention away from the drugs, or is that a factual finding? And if so, what do we take it as?
I suggest it's an incorrect finding. because there was no testimony by the officer that Mr. Moore made any furtive movements at all. The only movement, and he testified to it as such. He was directly behind the car, following the car, and stopped it and saw Mr. Moore make no movement at all, and testified that there was no movement at all other than at Officer Patton's request to retrieve the items that were taken from the store. Furthermore, there was no movement towards the under the passenger seat where the items were found after a search. He reached into the back seat to retrieve the items. I suggest that the Commonwealth argued that there were furtive movement, but there was no evidence to support that finding.
So if it's a factual finding, it's a factual finding because it's just plainly wrong.
I suggest that it was.
Ms. Finneas, do you have any additional argument that you would like to make?
I would only conclude that by, based upon the evidence presented, that one, the court was wrong in its factual finding that there was furtive movement, and secondly, that there were no other indicias of knowing and intentional possession. There was no attempt to exhibit dominion and control over the vehicles, that taken as a whole, the entire case was based upon the proximity to the illegal substances, and everyone knows the law is clear on that a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt cannot be based on simply proximity to the item in question. If he had been making movement towards the item under the seat, that would be a different story. But in this case, he was only making a movement in response to the police officer's direction to give him back the stolen items. And all of the inferences that might have been made were properly made in a case such as this were only made because of the proximity to the item, and not because there were the correct amount of factual information to determine that Mr. Moore was knowingly and intentionally possessing either the marijuana or the cocaine. And I would
thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have something else?
No, I was just going to say that was my conclusion.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the panel?
None from me. Thank you.
No further questions. Thank you, Ms. Vaness.
Thank you.
Mr. Chandabelle.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, Chris Chandabelle for the Commonwealth. I'd like to begin my argument just by noting the ruling by the trial court, which is actually at issue in this case. On brief and in the assignment of error, Moore has asserted that the court erred in finding beyond a reasonable doubt that he was guilty. Of course, on appeal, the only ruling that can be at issue is the trial court's determination in ruling and denying the second motion to strike and ruling that the evidence was sufficient as a matter of law to go to a fact finder for determination. So, of course, that has, I think, two implications in this case. The first is that the question on appeal is not whether the beyond a reasonable doubt finding, whether this court may or may not agree with that finding, but whether or not any rational finder of fact could have come to that conclusion. And then secondly, it's also relevant to the evidence in the record that this court looks to in determining whether that would be a rational determination. And because the court is required to look at the second motion to strike, the evidence, of course, includes Mr. Moore's testimony. And his testimony, as courts in Virginia have held on multiple occasions, repeatedly, that testimony, the trial court is entitled to infer that Mr. Moore was lying, and not just that he was lying, but that he lied in order to conceal his guilt, and that his lies and his testimony evince a guilty knowledge. And in Irvin versus Commonwealth, this court held that testimony, a defendant's lies while testifying, constitutes evidence of guilty knowledge of hidden contraband. In that case, marijuana was found in the glove compartment, and the court found that this court found that the trial court was entitled to disbelieve the defendant's testimony at trial, and that those lies at trial constituted evidence of his guilty knowledge of the location of the drugs which were hidden in the glove compartment. So I would contend that while it's true that this court has held that mere proximity by itself as a matter of law is not sufficient to prove guilty knowledge, that here we have much more than that. Here we have...
Counselor, am I right that what you're contending is that the evidence of knowledge is shown by the trial court's conclusion that the defendant was lying?
I think we have three categories of evidence that, taken together and considered in their totality, support a reasonable inference that that there was guilty knowledge. And those three categories are, first of all, the location of the drugs, which is not enough by itself, but it is still a factor to consider. Secondly, the conclusion that the defendant was lying, and that's affirmative evidence of his guilt, and according to Irvin, of his guilty knowledge of the hidden drugs. And then third, Mr. Moore's suspicious activity during the stop in turning around
and reflecting. What was suspicious? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. What was suspicious about his activity during the stop?
I would assert that it is reasonable for a fact finder to conclude that an individual who has just shoplifted items from a store and is getting away and does not know yet the purposes of a traffic stop when he's later pulled over, a trial court could infer that it's suspicious for that individual to remove the pants, put them in plain view on the back seat of the vehicle, and then when the officer comes to ask questions during the stop, to quickly and immediately confess, yes, officer, I'm sorry, I stole the pants, I apologize, here they are, and then to reach across and hand the pants out of the window. I think the trial court is entitled to listen to that testimony about how that interaction occurred and to determine for himself or herself, was that defendant being genuine and expressing true remorse, or could it be that the defendant knew that he was guilty of a much worse offense, having large amounts of cocaine and marijuana under his seat, and so in attempting to end that traffic stop as quickly as possible, and also to divert the officer's attention away from his seat, he put the pants in plain view in the back seat and then quickly reached back and handed them out the window to the officer, hoping that at that point the officer would accept the jeans and it would end the traffic stop and perhaps would never look under his seat and find that he was guilty of a greater offense. Now, I will concede that if that was the only evidence was the suspicious behavior, we might not have enough. If the only evidence was the proximity, we certainly wouldn't have enough under the case law. If the only evidence was false testimony at trial without the proximity, without the suspicious behavior, then perhaps we would not have enough. But we take those three categories of evidence and consider them together. I would assert that a rational fact finder could conclude that he had guilty knowledge that there were drugs underneath his seat. And I would just also encourage the court, there's been some argument from opposing counsel about the fact that a fact finder cannot simply rely on a defendant's prior felony to conclude that defendant is lying. Of course, we know that the fact finder can base its determination on prior felony, also based on the fact that this individual has incentive to lie, so he's clearly biased if he's testifying on his own behalf in a criminal case. He's also guilty of a crime of moral turpitude, which he's conceded in this very case, which is shoplifting. And then finally, I'd also just like to point out what this court has recognized multiple times in deferring to a trial court's determination that a defendant is lying on the stand, is that there are many factors that a trial court can consider in weighing a witness's testimony, including the witness's demeanor on the stand, whether the witness appears nervous, whether the witness takes long pauses at important places in the record, whether the witness might be sweating. These are all things that are only available, can only be seen by the trial court in the courtroom.
This is Judge Beals. Can I ask you on that?
Yes, Your Honor.
You referred to the Irvin case, and of course in Irvin there were a number of factors that added up, mounted on each other to come to the totality of circumstances where the court ruled, to bring the court to the ruling that it did. here, the trial court says he doesn't believe appellant, but he says it differently. He says, I find from the evidence, first, the defendant who's testified is not necessarily to be accorded by the court the benefit of truthfulness. He's a convicted felon. He's engaged in larcenous conduct, which was observed in the store. So as you point out, it is a crime of moral turpitude, but he stops at that point and then moves on. He doesn't talk about anything about observing his testimony or his body language or his tone of voice or how he appears on the stand. It's all about that he's a convicted felon and that he has conceded the shoplifting, which is a crime of moral turpitude. Is that a difference from Irvin or other cases where the court either explicitly or implicitly bases his non-belief of a defendant on what he observed in the testimony?
I would submit that if it is a distinction, it's a distinction without a difference for a couple of reasons. First of all, trial courts, of course, are not required to put their reasons on the record to support
their
conclusions. But here he put at least some of his reasons on the record. So the question should then be, I guess, whether on appeal the trial court's decision to at least partially explain his decision on the record should be held against him in terms of limiting him to the factors that he stated on the record. And I would submit that I personally have not seen a case, Irvin or any other case, where there's been a kind of parsing of the trial court's credibility finding in order to try to determine, okay, are these things that we can, judgment calls that we can review on a cold record, or has he also stated additional factors that aren't visible on a cold record? I would assert that the standard on appeal is considering whether a rational fact finder could have reached this conclusion. And of course, you also have, kind of in the background of all of this, the Supreme Court's opinion in Perry versus Commonwealth, that even in a case where the trial court states some of its reasons on the record, that the appellate court is entitled to conclude that the trial court was correct, but may have been right for the wrong reasons. And so the trial court is required to look at the facts that are in the record and ask itself, Are there any facts in the record by which a rational fact finder, maybe not even this particular one, but any rational trier of fact, could have concluded that this defendant was guilty? And I would assert based on that I guess I would discourage the court from kind of holding the trial court to the few reasons delineated on the record and frame the issue as
saying that
trier of fact.
On Perry, the trial, we could say right for the wrong reason based on other facts in the record that he didn't reference, but we should assume he was implicitly relying on, perhaps.
Right, and I guess I would assert that if a trial court can be right for the wrong reasons, then a trial court should also be able to be right for additional reasons. So in other
words, can you distinguish right for me, it seems like that there certainly could be an argument made that the Corden v. Commonwealth case could control in reference to these circumstances. Are you familiar with that case?
Corden?
Virginia, yeah, Corden, C-O-R-D-O-N. It's a Virginia Supreme Court case, and it reversed the conviction of constructive possession of cocaine when the evidence did not sufficiently link the appellant to the drug, despite the trial court's conclusion that appellant lied to conceal his guilt, which is somewhat similar to what we have here.
I'm honestly not familiar with the facts of that case. I would be curious as to where the drugs were found in that particular case. Because in this case,
it was a constructive possession case as well, and I'm trying to remember right now where they were found.
I guess I would, two responses. First of all, in this case, we have the additional factor of the suspicious conduct of the defendant, which I would assert a reasonable fact finder could read one of two ways, could conclude he just felt remorseful and felt bad and gave up the fruits of his crime, but also could come reasonably conclude that he was trying to divert the officer's attention away from the drugs under his feet. I would rely on
counsel, couldn't you just as easily argue that had he not offered up the shorts, that obviously he was lying, he had been lying about his shoplifting and therefore was untruthful. I mean, ultimately he committed a crime, but he was, you know, between catch 22, either he offered it up or he denied it, one of the two. So, you know, when the officer asked, well, I don't see how that can be considered ultimately in looking at, I can see how that obviously the crime of shoplifting, but the fact that he offered them in consistent with the officer's request could be that you could.
I don't mean to interrupt. I understand the court's question and concern there. I think that, first of all, he wasn't asked, you know, will you, according to the testimony in the record, the question was not, give me the pants now. The question was, did you take something you didn't pay for? And he immediately said, yes, I did. Here are the pants, and I'm sorry, and handed them out the window. So he went a little further than the officer's request. And secondly, I think the case might have been slightly less suspicious if he had still been sitting in the seat wearing the pants, or if he had hidden the pants somewhere in the car, and then when the officer came to the window and said, I know you're at Kohl's, I know you stole something, do you have those pants? If at that point he had given up the pants, then he's already known that his cover is blown and that the officer knows that he stole the pants. But before even knowing why he's being pulled over, he has taken off the pants and put them in plain view in a place where the officer can see them and just approaching the car, on the back seat, and then immediately turns them over. So there's absolutely no effort whatsoever to kind of wait it out and see, okay, how is the officer going to handle this stop? Are we being stopped for speeding or for something else? I think he went above and beyond in trying to end the traffic stop and to call the officer's attention away from himself and away from his seat and where he was sitting and to a place in plain view in the back seat. And again, I'll cite Castaneda versus Commonwealth, a case where the defendant immediately got out of the car and went around to the back of the car, opened the trunk, pulled out a duffel bag, and started opening the duffel bag and offering to let the officer search the duffel bag. In that case, the Court of Appeals held that a reasonable fact finder was entitled to infer that that defendant was trying to divert the officer's attention away from the drugs that were in the back seat of the car and instead to the back of the car and to the duffel bag. I don't feel like I need to necessarily convince this court that these individuals, you know, that your honors would necessarily reach the same conclusion if you were sitting in a trial court's position, but just that is a reasonable conclusion for a rational fact finder to conclude. And so to hold as a matter of law that no rational fact finder could consider the fact that the drugs were right under his seat in the exact place where they would be if he had quickly hidden them there when the officer came to arrest, and that no reasonable fact finder can consider his behavior and reaching back and putting the jeans in plain view and then quickly turning them over, and no reasonable fact finder could consider his lies as evidence of his guilty knowledge and can combine those and conclude that in their totality, that was evidence of his guilty knowledge. I just don't think the case law in Virginia has ever gone nearly that far, and I would assert that this is not a good case to create new case law that says as a matter of law, those three categories of evidence are just not enough to support that reasonable inference of guilty knowledge.
Thank you. Are there any additional questions from the panel?
None from me. Thank you.
None for the questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel Ms. Maness and also Mr. Chandeville. You've done an excellent job arguing your case. Again, today has been a real privilege to serve. We've had two very good cases with argument by counsel, and it's a wonderful way.